So, one of the things that we've thought a lot about, but we didn't realize what we're actually doing, is when we're bringing all these 276, 278 applications.
Which are pretrial applications regarding evidence of a sexual nature
Yeah,
or
so
documents in our possession.
yeah, so
Footnote
so
Diana.
applications to try and get in other sexual activity or other documents like messages between the parties that explains something relevant to our defense or contradicts the complainant. We're doing it, interestingly enough, and in a few cases, in a complete vacuum of what evidence the Crown intends to call.
Because we just have police statements where the person could be rambling and talking about, the last 10 years of their life, whereas the accusations, there might be one allegation that's just from one particular day or might have happened in one particular week. But instead, our statement goes on about, oh, what a jerk the person was for the last 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Yeah. And there's so wrapped up in the complainant's video statement with police is a lot of bad character evidence.
Tons.
And other evidence. And then so we're taking the evidence of the complainant at its highest, and we want to contradict certain aspects. And then we have a client who says, well, I can, here's a message that shows that she's actually not telling the truth about something that happened towards the end of a relationship, even though the sex assault allegedly might have happened 3 years earlier. And that shows, a credibility problem. And then you sort of, this is just an interesting phenomenon we went through recently, because when we read some of the responses from the Crown, they don't give a roadmap.
No.
They just say why it's not admissible, or you didn't meet the test, or whatever the f they say, which are the
The
boilerplate
template,
ones.
yeah, the boilerplate.
And there is no roadmap to their own case. And it's starting to get on my nerves, like really get on my nerves. Like, can you just f tell us how you're calling your f evidence?
Let me
Right?
break
Just
this.
f write it out. Because we're writing, we literally are down to the minutiae of what f happened during the assault, after, why it's relevant, why each document matches what.
Why can't you do that? Yeah.
And so we've a couple of interesting things we'll talk about, but it's so weird now. No roadmap.
Yeah. So by that, just to simplify, we have to assume that the complainant's going to say what they said in their police statement
That's all we
because
got.
that's what we have.
Thank you, honey.
And then there's certain things that may not be relevant to the thing, but we have to put that in almost like doing the Crown's application, suggesting they're likely to lead this because
We
we
think they're
haven't been
going to
told
say this, yeah.
otherwise.
We think they're going to
And
say
that's the
this.
roadmap that we're talking about, because then we come across cases where the Crown goes, well, I'm not going to lead that evidence.
Right.
I'm only going to talk about this particular day. And it's like, okay, well, it would
You
have been
didn't tell
nice,
us, yeah.
because we wouldn't have to do this entire massive application unless if we knew that the Crown's case was going to be limited. But then we also have the problem that some of these witnesses, when they go up there, they'll just start
Yeah, the whole
beacon
they
off
will,
and saying all kinds of things, whether they're supposed to or not.
but I remember in the old days when me and a Crown would talk and we'd say, okay, lead.
Yeah.
Why don't you lead through this evidence and direct the witness to where we're going to go so we can avoid this inadmissible evidence,
Right.
and we'd all be on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
We're titling this episode Putting Sex Back in the Box, by the way.
It's not a
And that's
drink.
your title, because this is good. This is going to be interesting. But this is part of, like, when we talk about what it is to defend a sexual assault case. So again, we've talked about various aspects of it. It's very serious. They're complex. There's a lot involved. But this is now about something that's bothering us. So in pretrials and judicial pretrials, before you get to set down your motions, you're supposed to talk about the evidence. But the reality is at that stage, we say, we're bringing a motion. I have messages. Here's what it's relevant to. That's why I need the motions. The Crown's like,
That's nice.
Thank
Thank you.
you.
And we often have a section that's literally titled Crown-led sexual evidence. And that's
Can you explain that a little bit
yeah.
more for? Because we've now done this in a number of our applications so that we can frame all the arguments and relevance. Can you just explain that for a
So
bit?
we'll take all of the statements of other sexual history that come up in the complainant statement, and we don't want to talk about them, but we put them in a section saying Crown-led, anticipated Crown-led sexual history evidence, and then we'll list out all the page numbers and all the different types of statements made by the complainant that are not the subject matter of the charge. And they're saying, now, given that, we expect the Crown to be leading this evidence. That's why we're asking to
Heard
be
this,
able to
yeah.
cross-examine on these subjects. And then this is why the Crown will see that section and go, oh, well, I'm not going to say that. But you know.
Okay, so how does it unfold from that point?
These applications can be helpful because it causes the Crown to rethink if they were going to lead that evidence or not.
If we didn't say it, it would just be a show at trial, right? And because technically, if the Crown is going to call other sexual evidence, they have to bring an application. They have to bring a Seboyer application, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they don't.
Well, they don't. It doesn't have to be in writing, as they've determined now. It sounded like they had to bring
just,
an actual...
Just, it could be just that day of trial.
Right.
Right? So we don't know.
Yeah.
We have to assume it's all going to come out. Mm-hmm. But if we don't do this, then it's literally a show at the end of the day, because the trial will totally get derailed.
Right.
Give an example. You know, if the complainant says, let's say there's an intoxication thing, and they're asserting that they know they didn't consent, even though they're kind of blackout, but they would never have consented because their habit was this, certain sexual practice. I mean, we've said to Crown before, like the case in Kingston, one of those ones, and we said, well, if you ask that question, then it opens it up for us to cross-examine on that fact. You're saying you never did this thing before, but what if I have evidence that you did? And then it's prior sexual history that's a proper rebuttal. And then the Crown in that case just went, you know what, I'm not going to ask that question.
Right.
So it's, you know, part of the value of these applications, as we've said, it's, you know, it seemed like it was improper and unfair in some ways, but it's actually been quite productive in some ways as well, because like now we've had cases where it could go from multiple days of testimony because the allegations and comments that were made, not just the allegation, but the comments cover such a large time frame. And then our guy has to testify about this whole span of allegations that aren't related either. If you can agree that the only relevant time frame is much narrower, then faster trial, less pressure on everybody, right, and it's focused.
And you can eliminate potentially dangerous evidence, so we can put the sex back in a box.
So that phrase I use because, you know, it's frustrating sometimes.
Let's sex say people in the box, yeah.
I called it, it's like having sex in the box.
I'm going to count how many times they say this for
no,
this
No, it's really important because this is how they...
But it's got a good visual to
judges
it.
Judges say this to us. Judges say this to us, and Crown attorneys said... that how is that relevant to consent at that particular occasion?
Right.
And it's like, it goes about credibility because they've characterized the relationship in a certain way. That's not true. We need to rebut it. That's how it's relevant. Well, how does that relate to whether they gave consent on that day? Oh my God, the case law is clear. But you still get the argument.
Yes.
And some judges rule that way.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And we had a high-profile case that was like the transcript from the original trial was actually made public and everything. It was a case from Alberta. And just to let's talk about the concept, you're at a party and there's a room in which sex takes place, and so that's your box, right?
Okay.
And in this particular case, there was a witness who was able to say, well, I was in that room and I left because I asked the complainant, are you going to have sex with this guy? And she went, uh-huh. And they went, okay, I'm out. And then the prosecutor tried to block that evidence, saying, well, she doesn't know what happened the moment the door was closed. So that's the box. And they're saying, mm-hmm. You know, nothing, you know, the only people who can testify about anything mm-hmm. are then the people who were in that box, and what they did before they went in the box and what they did after they came out of the box, completely irrelevant. And I like that example because narrowing it down to what happened on a single day isn't as much, it's not as small a box as that.
Yeah.
Right? But there's a point of absurdity. Well, you know, because the Crown always says, well, why did you go over to that person's house? Well, that's outside the box. I'm sorry. Why are you asking that question?
Right. But so what's happened to us, interestingly, now is so in one case, the allegation was more towards the front end of their relationship. And then the relationship goes on for a year and a half. And this complainant statement is replete with character assassination of our client. And at the end, there's a bunch of things that are relevant from our client's point of view. To undermine the credibility of the complainant. And so we go through the exercise. And then, you know, we say, as we're rethinking it with the Crown attorney, how about we just focus on this? Mm-hmm. How about we put sex back in a box? And why did we do that? And this is important because we had to explain to our client, and we have this in another case, why, you know, there's the law of diminishing returns, right?
Right.
You're going to have all this other shit you're going to have to answer
mm-hmm.
if and we go that route.
Screw up.
And potentially screw up, which will really deflect from what the issue is here, and we've got enough to cross-examine here. But it's an it's really intricate, because a client can be just so fixated on, but I can prove that the person lied about their hair color. Because they lied about their hair color,
therefore,
and their age, they must be lying about this. And sometimes there is truth to the fact that that's kind of peripheral. Mm-hmm. And it's a year and a half later and could be related to all sorts of other stuff. Collateral evidence rule. But I want to say peripheral, like it's still maybe kind of relevant, but it's really not going to move the needle that much. Right. And there could, and then the way the person has portrayed things at a certain stage could be related to all that bad character evidence. And maybe we don't want that.
Don't want to go there. Yeah.
You know?
And well, because it's like, you know what, another one of my favorite expressions of sex in the box, and it's like sword fighting a fart. Right? Why are you going to put all that energy out?
Bartender and come up with all these.
No, that's an extremely apt
it is
way of saying it.
Yeah.
You know? Like it's like sword fart, like, because it's like we don't know what we're facing.
We know there's something there, but it's really kind of hard to
smell it,
pin it down. Yeah. You know which direction to swing, but there's nothing solid to really hit. But then if you're swinging that sword around, you're wasting all that energy when you could be focused on the things that actually matter.
And that's because...
At which point the analogy falls apart.
Somewhat.
And that's because Crown attorneys will take a position, you know, well, this is, of course, subject to what the complainant says during their testimony. And we're like, that's exciting.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to be here to work through what the evidence is, what's admissible, what isn't. We have to bring this motion. How about you tell us what you think you're going to be calling, and then actually try and make sure that's what you're calling? Because if you know this is inadmissible, don't elicit it. You say, if the witness starts to say, nope,
we're not going.
I don't want to hear that. That's not relevant for us today. This is the area I want you to answer questions. There's nothing wrong with that. We've actually... I don't know why this dawned on me this way. We've actually allowed the complainant to be in control of what's admissible and what isn't. And that's not right.
Totally. I've seen that myself. Yeah.
Although we have in application said, like, you know, evidence from the statement or, you know, aspects of the statement that we object to. We have actually outlined stuff.
But think about that.
That we would object to it if she says certain things.
We have. So what we're doing now is we've got the 276, 278. We put in there Crown-led evidence. And then we put in a bad character, our objection to a bad character evidence. Well, it's their application to bring, but we do that anyways. We're doing multiple applications because we're not getting any of that up front. And I think there is, I don't know if it's fear. I don't know if it's because of all of the push for, you know, listening to complainants and complainants being able to testify and everything. They're almost dictating what's relevant or not. So if they just want to say whether it's admissible or not, it can just come out and then we'll see where that takes us. No, we have these rules in place. So we've recently started going, well, let's just pare this down a little bit more. Mm-hmm. How about we restrict your evidence to this, and therefore we don't need to get into this.
Can we get a little focus here, please?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, some of those statements are just like,
endless.
It's almost insane.
They just go on and on and on.
And then it's not linear, and you're kind of like trying to figure out where this timeline is. Like, was that supposed to be before or after? It gets kind of crazy. But we've mentioned bad character evidence. And, you know, it's not just, you know, stuff like a criminal record or something like that. There's certain things that...
character evidence that is not criminal in nature.
And it goes to...
But it can be interpreted as being bad.
And it goes to two lines of reasoning that are to be avoided, and that's moral prejudice and propensity evidence. Right. So, Michael, do you want to explain what that means?
No, I'm not fascinated listening to you. I'm waiting for the next analogy.
So, to say that somebody... let's take an example. They would just suddenly get angry and pound, pound the table.
They would get mad at all sorts of small things. Throughout the relationship, they would get really mad about that, and that would really bother me or scare me. And therefore, you know, getting angry in and of itself isn't a crime,
right?
But it can lead to moral prejudice. In other words, that's not a nice person.
No, he gets angry a lot.
Maybe he's controlling. Maybe he's coercively controlling. Mm-hmm. It can seep in and become very insidious.
Or we've had things too. It's just like, they were an obsessive gambler. Okay. I'm sorry, how does that relate to whether or not they sexually assaulted you?
Right.
But, you know, there's things like that too that could be a moral prejudice against somebody where they'd be like, oh, this is somebody who lacks self-control, right?
They're cheating.
You know, why in the world is that? Yeah, why in the world is that relevant? And you know, the propensity thing is like basically all of these statements are intended to lead to prior fact. Yeah, when you add them all together, you're creating a picture of somebody who you then say, well, this person has a propensity to, they're more likely to have committed this act they're accused of because they're a bad person.
So are you finding a pushback on boxing or no?
Not in the case we did recently, which I think both the judge welcomed and the Crown Attorney was very good about. And I think it was extremely helpful because it was very good for our client to give much more coherent evidence and not be sidetracked by things that are really not relevant. Mm-hmm. And we gave up certain things to cross-examine on, which again, I didn't think would move the needle very much. I mean, as a lawyer, when you're asking questions in cross-examination, you always have to do the calculation. You got to know why you're asking that question. Oh, yeah. And if you don't know why you're asking that question, don't ask that question. If that question is not going to elicit evidence that's helpful or get you down a path that you need to go, then you don't ask it.
Right?
So you have to think the same way about evidence you may have in your hand that may be able to impugn a witness on their reliability or credibility a little bit, but it may not be that significant because it may elicit other shit.
Well, it's going to open doors that you don't want
to
go down.
What's the point having your client, who's obviously going to be, in most cases, really stressed out, having to deal with, you know, really sensitive personal information, you know, that all of a sudden they're going to be stuck there having to testify to and get cross-examined on things that are completely irrelevant.
Absolutely. And I think the only reason, I mean, we always knew this and we've been building this into our applications anyways, but I think it's just become a little bit more of a pain in the ass right now because there's so little emphasis from the other side to tell us how you're going to go about calling your evidence. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in another example, there is all this other evidence about a relationship that was on and off for a period of time, how the complainant says that they were unhappy with our client and like the look of his face scared me and you know he wanted to always engage in this particular type of sexual act which never occurred, but that's happens to be something like the allegation. And then as you try and sift through it, eventually you can try and get the Crown to crystallize at the time of the motion as to what really is relevant. And it's like, it just would be nice sometimes, just sometimes. And I know somebody who watches this might go, well, bring a motion for directions or particulars.
Agreed statement of facts, something.
Well, that you can engage the Crown on, but what you're really asking is, we want to go to a court to force the Crown to tell us what they're going to call. Because we get it, we get one 144 page statement. I mean, it's a long statement, so we transcribe it. Then you get a second statement and a third statement. So you've got like three statements, you've got 300-400 pages of stuff to read, and it's like, okay. It'd be, you know, I suppose we could bring a motion. Problem is, we have to be economical with our client's money.
I mean, it'd be...
How do you afford to bring then that motion for a direction as to what the Crown's going to do? That may not be actually an accurate reflection. You still have to bring your other motion.
Yeah.
We've given up on that. We said, let's just do the whole thing.
But really, do we need to go all the way through a court process just in order to get the Crown to respond,
case.
Which they could just do in an email,
right.
You know?
What's your case?
And I have to say, in the Superior Court, when we do judicial pretrials, I found some judges to be much more prodding on, okay, Crown, tell me.
What's your case? What's the theory?
What's the case?
Yeah.
How are you calling this evidence? Because Mr. Neuberger is saying he wants to do this. What are you going to do?
Right.
And then, of course, we had the problem, too, where it's not always the same Crown when we go to trial. And so we had that circumstance where saying, well, I'll tell you this, I wouldn't lead this evidence, but mm-hmm. I don't know what the other Crown's going to do.
Say that again slowly.
That's really annoying.
So everybody can get aggravated by
yeah.
it.
So,
aggravation time.
Yeah, you know, the prosecutor who's preparing the case and making earlier decisions and sometimes all the way up to attending these pretrial motions won't necessarily be the same prosecutor when you go to trial. So in this case, the prosecutor's going, well, I can tell you, I would not lead this prior right. evidence, you know, character evidence. I wouldn't open up doorways that require us mm-hmm. to address any of this stuff. But I don't know for sure what the other Crown's going to do because it's probably not going to be me at trial.
Yeah.
What do you do with that?
You get really angry.
And what happens is you get a ruling from the judge
right.
saying, you can't call this evidence, Mr. Neuberger, because the Crown has said they're not calling this other sexual history.
That's not precisely what was said. is very kind of like non-committal, saying I don't really know what the other prosecutor is going to do.
No, but that's the ruling. The ruling is I'm relying upon what this with this Crown had said, and then later on, that may not be the case. So you have to bring a mid-trial ruling, a mid-trial application.
Reopen it, yeah.
You have to reopen it.
But, you know, in terms of like containing stuff and trying
let's
to,
talk about
trying
that
focus,
for a moment.
Right? It's beneficial to everybody, and especially with our backlogs in our courts. If we can, this is trial management.
Right.
And, you know, it's not just good for the accused person to narrow the stuff down. It can be frustrating for them sometimes. But, you know, and then just kind of aside to that, it's important that the accused person understands why these decisions are being made, because otherwise they'd be sitting there going, but I had all these emails where, you know, she got angry at me like a year later. And it's like, well, it doesn't matter because, you know, the allegation wasn't made at that time frame.
Or got angry at me a year before.
You know, or a year before. You know, this isn't it doesn't go to motive, but it, in their mind, it'll stand out important. So it's important that they understand everything we're talking about.
And it's not easy because, again, their lives are on the line. They're nervous. Their concept is if they told me X, Y, and Z and I have evidence of X, Y, and Z, that shows that they're a liar. Therefore, if they're a liar about this, why doesn't that impact their credibility here? And as we've said before, you know, it's got to be substantive. There has to be some
meat to it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's got to be, yeah. The flip side is the Crowns now have to deal with this victim rights legislation, of the victim.
That's an important point that I wanted to get into here.
Yeah.
And there's been some amendments to that lately, hasn't there?
Yeah, I
just ignore it because I find it aggravating.
Well, I know there was a change recently in that there's an automatic publication ban before, and now they have to actually ask the complainant if they
that's
want
fair.
A publication ban.
Yeah,
but a lot of these Crowns are terrified to make these decisions because they're worried about complaints.
But I think if you factor it into evidence, so let's think about when we want to put sex in a box and we want to say, well, you know, most of what the complainant is saying is not relevant.
It's historical, it's not relevant.
Nor is it admissible.
Right.
I can imagine on the other side the fear or the concern that a particular complainant will say, I was prevented from telling my story and my evidence.
I insist on testifying.
And I
about
wanted
this.
To give my evidence and I wasn't allowed.
I know one case where there were like, there was more than one charge and different time frames or whatever, and the Crown decided to withdraw certain charges.
Yeah.
And you could hear the complainant when she was informed. You could hear her screaming
right
outside the courtroom. She was so furious.
It's a, you know, again, they'll talk about the balance of, you know, the rights have to inure both to the complainant and to the accused. As much as it's that line from JJ that's always disturbed me, you know. Reporting rates and conviction rates are low. We must do more.
Must
do better, or we must do more, whatever it is. And there is a lot of cases where you can focus better, remove prejudicial evidence that's not relevant, not expose your client to basically a character assassination, and there is enough information to cross-examine on. And then the other flip side is we have to still be very strident in pushing the envelope about why clients can be believed when they testify. You know, WD, J. Jared D. is a pain in the ass. We've got good writing and law on why we do the analysis we do with Justice Pachauco's Doubt About Doubt, you know, his article. And, you know, we really got to focus on these principles, presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, how you manage the WD analysis, and sometimes just try and eliminate the noise and focus on what's really relevant. But we've got these competing interests here.
We do, and Crowns are terrified. Many Crowns are terrified of their own complainants, I'm finding.
And the problem isn't...
I had a Crown today. Perfect case for a peace bond, for example, where he gave me an example of another case where he said, yeah, should have been a peace bond. I mentioned it to the complainant. She lost her shit.
But, you know...
The exercise of discretion seems to be fettered.
But, you know, here's the thing, like, we must have said this a million times, and I don't know how to, I understand from a person who's not a lawyer and not in the system, and they're charged, and they'll go, I don't understand, I didn't do anything wrong, this should be straightforward, you know, I don't want to pay these kind of fees.
Right.
Why is this going to trial?
The lawyer told me it's simple, so I'm just going to do it myself
sometimes.
Or I'll go with the lawyer who tells me it's simple.
Right.
And then you get the call for the appeal.
Right.
Right. And then literally, I circulated the email because I said, this is like an email. I wish we could show potential clients that somebody in a desperate situation reached out and said, you know, I thought this was straightforward. I didn't do anything wrong. Nobody cared about my side when I was at trial. And they're looking at 4 or 5 years convicted. And we've said, and it's not a sales pitch.
No.
There's a lot of very good lawyers in this province, but it's a lot of f-ing work. The access to justice issue here is a big issue.
Yeah.
It is difficult for people to be able to muster their own and pay for their own defense.
No one budgets for a criminal law crisis. There's a fair amount of
unrepresented accused people.
Yeah.
And it's a problem.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the main point for what we've been talking about is just to point out the important thinking that needs to go into these cases strategically about how to focus the evidence and how you're going to structure your defense. It's like, it's so important to really think these things through instead of just walking in and then rambling on, just like a complainant rambles in their police statement.
It's impossible. Quite often,
and then say things that they don't even understand, you know, how that could be twisted and used against them. It's like, that's why it's important to keep things as focused as possible.
Drafting out a 276, 278 application where you go through the evidence, go through the information from your client is, you know, 30, 40, 50 hours of work. Then once you got through that hurdle, you know, you got to think about your client's narrative. And when you want to draft the cross-examination, it takes hours. It takes a lot of hours, a lot of thinking. We talk about it as a group. It's, you know, you're playing through various levels of multi-level chess in order to get to a cross-examination you think will be effective. You don't just walk in and start
winging it.
Yeah. You know, after 31 years, we still draft out everything.
And I think also too, it's important for people to understand that they'll think sometimes that we're not contacting the Crown over certain issues. And it's like, oh no, like our application was filed 3 months ago. We just managed to get a response and whittle the issues down yesterday.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like, or today even. The conversation continued. So it's not that messages aren't sent. It's just that, you know, the Crowns are dealing with other cases and they don't necessarily have time to read and think about it. So,
Well, look, let's be fair to them. I mean, I've spoken to some Crown attorneys and they were literally under their table with like too much emails, too much work. I know a Crown who unfortunately resigned, and she was a young Crown. She was excellent. I mean, I thought she did a really good job when she had prepared a cross-examination ahead of time, wrote it out, had a bit of a roadmap, and just said, I don't get any prep time. I can't keep up with this. So it's not like we don't have sympathy about it, but it's, again, there's no investment in the infrastructure of this system, which can lead to wrongful convictions or cases being stayed or all sorts of other bad things happening. But it's a lot of work. And, you know, I think it sort of struck us in these last two cases, sorry if I'm being repetitive, that, you know, after all the effort of putting in the application, putting in the bad character application, and then trying to get down to it, that's when you force everybody to think about the issues and go, okay, so, like, can you tell me how you're calling your case so we can get through this?
If we had that earlier, it'd be nice, but it's still worth the effort to put that in just to force people to really think these things through.
Look, it certainly focuses our defense and our cross-examination. All that thinking, all that work makes it much more efficient and effective. It may seem like a lot, but it really does help. But I think, you know, sometimes when we can put sex back in a box, it's not a bad thing.
Hey. On that note,
as long as the right size box.
Oh, here we go.
What size that'll be. Size doesn't matter.
Different sizes now. One size fits all. Dana.
Can you do the pillow talk?
Do the pillow talk, Dana. Oh, given the subject matter.
You like this podcast? Want to see more? Don't forget to like,
comment,
subscribe,
and share.
Thank
you. Good night, everybody.